Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So it's interesting that we've been talking all day today about the debate. We've been talking about voting. And I say it is interesting because there's an issue that's been going on in Florida, but I think it captures the attention of every state across the country because a recent decision in Florida that affects whether or not former felons can vote captures all of our attentions. And here to put it in some perspective for us is one of the attorneys directly involved in the fight. And yes, it has in fact been a fight. Is one of the attorneys direct. I'm sorry, I just said that, didn't I? Nancy Abudu is the deputy legal director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome to the show. She joins us on the DISC Institute of Pittsburgh Newsline. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And, you know, the issue of felons and the right to vote has been a contentious issue across the country. And in Florida, the issue became even more contentious when felons got the right to vote as long as they paid their outstanding fines. But that became an interesting argument because often those fines could be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, which in essence said, yes, you can vote if you can pay your fines, or in other words, if you had money.
That's right.
So what's happened since then?
Well, so I guess just one point of clarification. Last November, almost 65% of Floridians agreed to the automatic voter registration or eligibility of people with criminal convictions with no strings attached, with only two, you know, I guess, categories of people with criminal convictions carved out, but the overwhelming majority of people in that category would be eligible for automatic restoration upon completion of prison, parole, and probation. And then in May of the next year is when the state legislature, with the support of the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, decided that they would condition that automatic restoration on the payment of fines and fees, as you just explained. And so we, along with a number of other coalition partners, sued the state of Florida, arguing many things, including the fact that this financial requirement is equivalent to a poll tax, something that the U.S. Supreme Court and our U.S. Constitution outlawed decades ago because of the very real impact that it has on certain communities, especially communities of color, low-income individuals, folks who are at or barely above the poverty line, and the list really goes on.
Indeed, it does. And quite often, these are individuals who are fighting to put their lives back together. They are fighting to become productive members of society. And I'm guessing from their perspective or their viewpoint, sometimes it feels like it's one hurdle after another to reintegrate back into the community.
That is absolutely correct. And because there are so many hurdles, it goes from being, coincidence to actually being intentional. We know for sure that the law that Florida erected with respect to the payment of fines and fees is going to have a disparate impact on communities of color, as I said, low-income communities. And then when you combine that, our clients are African-American women who have struggled to find permanent employment at a livable wage since their completion of their sentence, and having that brand just as of having a conviction on your record is a serious obstacle in terms of finding employment. So you have folks who were already, you know, at some disadvantage when they entered the system. They're definitely at a disadvantage when they exit the system. And then you essentially pass a law, Florida, that says you can never, ever vote simply because you're poor.
And I'm guessing, and this might be a little bit outside of the realm of our conversation, but I don't think it is too much. When you look at the work that you guys are involved in this Southern Poverty Law Center, sometimes it would seem on the surface that things like socioeconomic factors wouldn't be a consideration when you are talking about fighting for the right of convicted felons to vote. But is it interesting from your perspective sometimes how socioeconomic factors can filter into decisions every day that some other people probably don't even realize how that's utilized to be discriminatory?
It's complicated.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to make sure I was clear. I know I made that question wordy. I apologize.
No, but I get it. And you're absolutely right. And, you know, I would go a little bit further to say it's not just sometimes. It's almost all the time. Mm. Something, of course, I mean, this reenfranchisement bill and then saying you have to pay money, clear economic impact. Even something like a voter photo ID requirement. If you don't have the money to pay for the ID, that served as a barrier. And then states that said, well, we'll make the ID free, but you still had to pay for the underlying documents to qualify for getting the ID. That was an economic barrier. Something that people think might be as simple as, where do you vote? Where is your polling place? If you live in a rural area with very limited, if any, public transportation and you can't afford to have your own vehicle, that becomes a socioeconomic barrier to participating in the vote. So at SPLC, what we're trying to do is insert this economic aspect when it comes to voting so people can really connect the dots and understand that even the most innocuous looking bill has some serious consequences.
Which in itself, as we talk about 2020 and we talk about going into a presidential election year, I always find it interesting when people then want to revisit all of the ways they can keep people out of the polls. And sometimes people will talk about things and they don't even realize, or maybe they do, what some of these laws can do and how they can impact the outcome of an election.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things at the Southern Poverty Law Center that we're really emphasizing is the importance of the local elections. It shouldn't be that people only come out to vote every 4 years and then become very discouraged when they don't see the political landscape and the progressive policies that so many communities need being initiated or passed through. The answer is not to give up the fight to vote. The answer is to be even more adamant about protecting and expanding the right and to really holding our elected officials accountable so that they understand that they were hired to do a job, and if they don't do it in a way that is most beneficial for the communities they're representing, then they no longer should have that job. And we as voters really need to start approaching this system from a more of a slightly like an employer perspective, because that's really who we as voters are.
Indeed. Nancy Abudu, thanks so much for joining us today. Good information, especially in 2020. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Have a great day.
You
everyone.
Too.
Bye-bye.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.